You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 309, Exodus 32-33. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. All right, Mike. Well, we've got some special guests back on to talk about something special again.
Yeah, well, see how that works? Special guest to talk about something special. So, yeah, my wife is back on, Drina. She's been on before. We were talking about the Naked Bible Cruise, and with her is Sherry Geneser, who is the person on the cruise end, also a personal friend of ours who does this for a living and knows all about how cruises work. And that's who we've engaged to create the Naked Bible Cruise. So there's some sort of special deal going on. I'm going to turn it over to Drina and Sherry and just let them tell the audience what's going on.
Hey, everybody. It's nice to be back on again. And when I'm on, we're going to talk about something fun. So whenever you know that I'm coming on, you know, it's going to be something fun to do. I'm really excited about the Naked Bible Cruise and my friend Sherry Geneser, who's a really dear friend of mine. She's so good at what she does. She's a great multitasker. She has won awards at her job for what she does, which is putting together packages for people to travel. And I just want her to just explain a little bit about what she does and then this fabulous deal that is going to happen if you guys sign up to go on the Naked Bible Cruise. So go ahead, Sherry.
Thanks, Drina. Boy, I don't think I can live up to that at all. But yes, this is a passion of mine. Traveling is a passion of mine. And we have a fabulous trip planned on the Sky Princess, who is one of the new ships in the Princess fleet. So when we get on board, she'll be all sparkly and new. She was just launched this last October. We'll be heading out of New York, round trip, making it easy for people to come in and out. We'll have an opportunity to visit Newport, Rhode Island, also known as City by the Sea, as well as a day in Boston. And we get the opportunity to stop in Bar Harbor, which is famous for the Acadia National Park and Cadillac Mountain. Then we'll be heading across into Canadian waters and St. John, New Brunswick, which is famous for the Bay of Fundy. And our last port of call in Halifax, Nova Scotia. So we have a really beautiful itinerary planned, doing it in October. We're hoping that the fall foliage will be in all of its glory. And we have prize pointed, I think, cabin selections for just about everybody. So I have interiors, balconies, and mini suites. Right now, I have a promotion going that I have truly never seen the offering such as this. So the first thing is the premier beverage package. So that includes up to 15 alcoholic beverages a day, which if you were to consume that, I don't know how much of the trip you would enjoy, but you could do that. Specialty coffee for those of us who are very much our coffee snobs. Soda drinks, juices, milkshakes, things like that. That's all included in the premier beverage package, as well as the gratuities for that package.
I don't hear tea.
Specialty teas, Mike. Specialty teas. Just for you.
Okay. Just thought I'd let you know.
Okay. And even an occasional milkshake or a frappuccino. Okay. Also, that's included. Okay. That's a $495 value per guest. Okay. Then it's unlimited Wi-Fi. And because this is a new ship, the Wi-Fi on these ships is very fast. And you get one device for every guest. That's another $70 value. And then your prepaid gratuities, which is either between $101 and $108 per guest, depending on cabin selection. So the other beautiful thing is it's only a $200 deposit right now, and final payment isn't due until July 12th. So it's not like you have to pay for the cruise in full today. So the
big deal is all this stuff is looped in, you know, as
it
opposed
is all
to
looped
getting
in.
Hit piecemeal. Yeah.
If you were to look at it separately, like I say, it's probably an extra $800 and something per person.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And
that's a
great and they're offering it. So yeah, it's a fabulous deal right now. Truly fabulous deal. So we have cabins still available. I don't want to imply that it's getting too tight, but I do want to encourage people to sign up. And again, you're only going to be charged $200 deposit as soon as I get your request.
Now, all of this stuff getting lumped in, that's new. So
that is new.
How long does that last?
That's going to be finished up at the end of February.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's great. And then, you know, with all those perks, there's other areas to spend extra money on the ship if you want, right? So that frees up some money to like spend extra money, you know, like at the ports when we go ashore. And so that's right. Great. That's great. Right.
So there's shore excursion options. There's spas on board for anybody who might want to consider a massage or a pedicure or things like that. There's a lot of other things that you can spend. There's also shops on board to go shopping, as well as all of the ports of call. There's going to be lots of opportunities to indulge. And maybe you want to go have a lobster lunch while you're in Mar Harbor.
Is there a bookstore?
There's bookstores, Mike. On board the ship? No, but some of the ports of call are famous for some of their bookstores.
I know.
Boston. Lots of history on where we're going. Yeah.
That's great.
I just did want to touch on, I know Mike, you're going to be better at this, but I wanted to touch on the fact that we have 5 sessions scheduled. Mike will be speaking and he's talking on the Unseen Realm, A Deeper Dive.
Yep. Oh, I have lots of topics to jump into. So.
Yeah. Right. And let's not forget, one of the great things about this is getting to meet you people and connecting and making friendships. And to me, that's one of the biggest perks is getting to put a face behind names that we have seen through Instagram or Facebook or emails. Mm-hmm. And it's just great to meet people who, you know, love the content and love Mike and we love you guys too. And we're just excited to actually meet and spend time with you guys and make friends. So that's one of the biggest perks for me as well. And I know Mike feels that way too.
No, I do, but you're more of the people person, so you don't have to convince anyone.
So anybody that signs up for this cruise will get to correspond with Sherry because she is the one that she's the direct person that you will sign up under.
Yep. Yep. And the easiest way to do it is to go to nakedbibletours.com. It says there's a little tab that says join us. You'll be asked to do a signature authentication and then you'll fill out a form that will come directly over to me. That has your name, birthday, passport information, what kind of cabin selection you want, as well as your credit card information, and I'll get you booked.
Well, great. Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having Trey and Mike. Thanks for having us on and letting us steal a little bit of your time.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Mike. Well, I'm looking forward to it and can't wait.
Yep, it will be fun. You know, I've never been on one. I've just heard a lot of good things about them, so I'm looking forward to it.
Well, all right. I've got nothing else unless you would just get right into Exodus unless you have something else.
No, we might as well jump in here. You know, last time we focused just on chapter 32, so that was the Golden Calf episode. This time I'll revisit a few things from Exodus 32 and then loop in Exodus 33, you know, these two chapters, and again, just a little bit of chapter 34, but 34 we're going to keep for next time. The very, you know, famous episode of Moses being hid in the cleft of the rock, and you know, Yahweh passes in front of him, and all that. So I want to reserve that for its own episode. But these two chapters work, you know, hand in hand. Some parts of that are obvious, some parts of that are less obvious. So I want to get into the content of 33 today, but to do that, we got to reference some things in 32. And toward the end, I'm again going to give listeners a chance to get a hold of some articles that really deal with literary structure of the passages, because depending on how you perceive what the writer is doing with the arrangement of the material. You can actually sort of analyze both of these chapters, chapters 32 and 33, in different ways so that it highlights very specific teaching points. And again, this is Exodus. We've said this before about Exodus. We've said it before about biblical narrative, you know, historical narrative, like in the Torah and elsewhere. But, you know, since we're in Exodus, we'll just say the Torah. Back when we started, you know, the whole book, you know, the whole question of, you know, historicity, you know, ask yourself, well, what's history? This is not the way we would write history. But just because Exodus isn't written in a neat, linear, chronological fashion that appears to our eye comprehensive and consistent doesn't mean it's not history. The writers do this sort of thing. Again, what we would say, jumbling up material, putting things out of place, discussing one topic three or four different times in different places. And we'd ask, why don't you just discuss it all in one place? You know, that's the way it should be done. Well, they're not doing things the way we think they should be done. Okay, the writer, biblical writers just generally, and it happens in narrative a lot, they arrange the material in ways that may not be pleasing to our eye, but they do it deliberately so that their readers and their hearers, a lot of people would hear these stories, would be led to follow certain patterns. They would be looking for repetitions. They would be able to tell, because it's their culture, that the story is moving one way and it's going to reach a point and then hinge backward to really where it started. They're going to be able to recognize those patterns, and they're going to see that in those patterns there are things that the storyteller, whether it's verbal or written, wants us to focus on. None of that means that the stuff didn't happen. It just means that they're not doing history writing the way we would. And it's arrogant for us to condemn what they produce and question its historicity just because it doesn't conform to the way we would do it. And this is, these two chapters are another classic example of that. It's theologized, you know, history writing. It's written the way it is to teach theological truth, not to, again, survive a dissertation panel in a history department. That's not why they're doing it. So we need to think again differently about what's going on here. So last time, again, we went through the Golden Calf episode. We could start with, again, a little bit of, you know, rehashing, and we know the story. Moses is up on the mountain. He doesn't come down for 40 days. The people panic. They say, hey, you know, they go to Aaron. They basically surround him, intimidate him, and say, you know, make us gods, make us an Elohim that will go before us. And Aaron does that, and, you know, we get the golden calf. And as we talked about last time, it's very likely that they thought, again, what they're trying to do is bring Yahweh's presence back into the camp, because they are directionless and leaderless. They can't go back. They can't go forward. They're in a bad place, but it's unacceptable. And again, if we read 11 through 14 in chapter 32, you know, we get sort of the flavor of this outcome. God is angry, and he's threatening to destroy the people. And verse 11 says, but Moses implored the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power, with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, with evil intent did he bring them out, to kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger and relent from this disaster against your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have promised I will give to your offspring, and they shall inherit it forever. Then verse 14 says, and the Lord relented from the disaster that he had spoken of bringing on his people. So you get this episode here in 32, where God is angry. Moses essentially talks them out of annihilating the Israelites. But what happens is later in chapter 32, and this is going to affect, you know, some things in chapter 33. Moses gets angry. He gets as angry, really, it sounds, he gets as angry as God was at the Israelites. So that's like the tables turn. And it's not that God isn't angry, because God still seems angry at the end of chapter 32, because he punishes the Israelites with a plague when the chapter ends. I mean, let me read to you how the chapter ends. So again, think about this. Verses 11 through 14, Moses talks God out of destroying Israel. God relents. And then, you know, you go on, you know, with the rest of the episode, and you hit verse 25. When Moses saw that the people had broken loose, for Aaron had let them break loose to the derision of their enemies, then Moses stood at the gate of the camp and said, "Who is on the Lord's side? Come to me." So basically what's happened, let me just interrupt, is you have things just degenerating in the Israelite camp. They're out of control. You know, Moses comes down from the mountain, sees what's going on. The people are just out of control. And Aaron's not doing anything to help the situation. So again, even if they might have had good motives, they are now thinking, maybe they're thinking they're worshiping Yahweh, but it's just a free-for-all. There's immorality, there's debauchery, the whole bit. Okay, and so Moses sees this. He stands in the gate of the camp and said, "Who is on the Lord's side? Who's on Yahweh's side? Okay, we're gonna take care of this episode." So now the text of Exodus 32 doesn't have Moses pleading for them that God would be merciful. I mean, God told him what's going on there. He's saying that, you know, your people have, you know, forsaken me. They've forsaken what I commanded them. And Moses is like, "Oh, don't destroy them." But when Moses actually shows up and sees what's going on, now Moses has had it. And he says, "Who's on the Lord's side?" And all the sons of Levi gathered around him. Verse 27. And he said to them, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, put your sword on your side, each of you, and go to and fro from gate to gate throughout the camp, and each of you kill his brother and his companion and his neighbor." And the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses. And that day about 3,000 men of the people fell. And Moses said, "Today you have been ordained for the service of the Lord, each one at the cost of his son and of his brother, so that he might bestow a blessing upon you this day." So Moses launches a campaign of capital punishment against the people. And we're going to talk a little bit about this, like who exactly was involved here, who's the target. Moses essentially, you know, he says, "Thus says the Lord God," but again, God had, we think, or we presume, you know, had relented earlier. So how does God's answer to Moses earlier, "Okay, I won't destroy them," how does that jive with Moses going down there and saying, "Hey, you Levites, go kill the people responsible for this"? And even then, it's not over. Again, it feels like it just doesn't fit. It feels, you know, contradictory. Like, if God was okay, we're not going to kill them, why would Moses think that it was appropriate for him to do this, you know, to announce this? Or why would God change his mind and tell Moses to do this? And again, it just has this weird feel to it. Verse 30, the next day, so the day after the 3,000 of these men are killed, the next day Moses said to the people, "You have sinned a great sin. And now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." Well, what's that? I thought those responsible had just been dealt with. I thought God had already noticed that the text never actually said this, but the impression you get is, I thought God had forgiven them way back in verses 11 through 14. No, it just said that God relented. He didn't destroy them. He didn't. It doesn't actually say that he forgave them or anything like that. But it's very easy, you know, for us to look at this and wonder, well, what's going on here? I mean, shouldn't at least the prior verses 25 through 29, when these 3,000, you know, guys are killed for whatever they did, you know, in relation to the golden calf, why didn't that take care of the problem? Now it's like everybody's in trouble. In verse 30, "You've sinned a great sin. I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." Verse 31, you know, you're just wondering, how does this all go together? So Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Alas, this people has sinned a great sin. They have made for themselves gods of gold." Of course, God already knows that. Verse 32, "But now, if you will forgive their sin, but if not, please blot me out of your book that you have written." So Moses wants God to forgive them. And you could ask, well, didn't God already do that? And again, how does one section of the chapter fit with the other section of the chapter? Verse 33, the Lord said to Moses, you know, God's answer is pretty categorical. Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. But now go, you Moses, go. Lead the people to the place about which I have spoken to you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I visit, I will visit their sin upon them. Then the Lord sent a plague on the people because they made the calf the one that Aaron made. And that's the end of chapter 32. It just seems like people get punished more than once. People sort of get forgiven more than once, but then they still get punished more than once. What's going on here? Asarna, of course, notes this problem, and he even adds a little bit more to it. So here's what Sarna says in his commentary about this whole issue. Present section concludes with a declaration of divine forbearance. That's verse 14, God relents. Nevertheless, verses 30 through 34 record Moses' entreaty of God, and verse 30 expresses his hope that perhaps I may win forgiveness for your sin. To this complication may be added the fact that the parallel account in Deuteronomy 9, 15 through 21 has Moses descending the mountain immediately after being apprised of the situation below and making intercession only after breaking the tablets. So it's a little bit different than the one in Exodus here. Many modern scholars, Sarna says, explain the anomalies as resulting from the amalgamation of varying traditions. This is, again, source criticism. Ibn Ezra concludes that verses 11 through 14 are out of chronological sequence and belong after verse 31. They have been placed here because they are Moses' response to God's intimation in verse 10 that intercession would be effective. Understand the text differently, Ramban believes that verses 11 through 14 are in the correct place and that Moses made two separate intercessions. This is actually sort of a traditional view. This is me, commenting now. This is actually a fairly traditional view within like evangelical circles. Sarna continues, the first of these two separate intercessions, verses 11 through 14, was intended to gain rescission of the threat to destroy Israel, whereas the second, verses 30 through 34, was to obtain forgiveness after the pulverization of the golden calf and the punishment of the transgressors. Rambam notes that in the version in Deuteronomy, events are telescoped because the story appears in a different context and is narrated for a different purpose. And that's the end of Sarna's, little introduction to the problems. Now, other scholars don't see a contradiction. Again, they view it as two separate intercessions. Durham is sort of one of those in his Word Biblical Commentary. He writes a little bit about, how he understands things. He says the implication of this statement in verse 14, that God relents, is of course that he tempered but did not altogether waive his judgment. And this implication is confirmed in the continuation of the narrative at both 32, 34, and verse 35, and also into chapter 33, verse 17, and even chapter 34, verses 6 and 7. So Durham again is saying, well, these are sort of different, they're different focus points. God doesn't actually forgive them the first time. He just says, okay, I won't destroy them. But the issue of their forgiveness is still up in the air. And again, so there's two separate contexts, two separate intercessions here. And that's how Durham in Word Biblical Commentary handles it. And again, that's fairly common, as I noted before. Durham adds later on, he says, thus Moses reminding the people once more of the gravity of their sin in verses 30 and 35, announces to them that he will reascend the mountain toward Yahweh to seek atonement for them. He pleads with Yahweh, this time stating with candor the sin and its critical seriousness. In a phrase that seems awkwardly incomplete in Hebrew, either a word is dropped out or the narrator is attempting to represent Moses having difficulty saying what he wants to say, Moses asks Yahweh to forgive Israel or to erase his own name from the book Yahweh has written, a reference apparently to a register of those loyal to Yahweh and thereby deserving his special blessings. And he quotes Psalm 69:28, Isaiah 4:3, Ezekiel 13:9. We did a whole episode on heavenly books, by the way, this idea, and you could go back to the podcast, you Google the Naked Bible podcast, heavenly books, and you're going to find that. But the point here is that Durham's saying, look, it's two different things, two different contexts, different points of intercession. and he doesn't really see a contradiction here. Now, Yahweh, of course, replies, and he's not going to blot Moses out of his book. He's going to say the one who's going to be blotted out is the one who's guilty, and that God will, you know, God says he will visit their sin upon them. But who's going to get visited? It seems like the perpetrators were already killed. So, like, who's left? You know, Durham actually doesn't discuss that. He sort of omits that issue. And again, this is why others see real problems here, disjointing, some contradictory feel to it, and others, you know, sort of just don't. It's two different things. Who cares? As far as answering the question, though, of who's left for God to judge after the Levites killed off the golden calf offenders, the answer seems to be found in, again, Exodus 32, 26, and 29. Recall, you know, this is going to tell you sort of where I'm at a little bit. I do think there are differences between the two intercessions. So I tend to be a little bit more in the traditional camp here. But I think we have to loop some other things into the picture that I think justify that. So to this point, think about Exodus, where we've been in the book. The only priests consecrated to serve in sacred space were who? Aaron and his sons. We don't have a reference, and it seems odd because, you know, again, when we talk about the priesthood and the sanctification of the priesthood, you know, all those chapters about, you know, you build the ark, you build the golden lampstand, and the priests wear this and that, and, you know, they go through a ceremony and blood gets put on the ear and the toe, you know, it feels like it's easy for us to think that this is happening to the tribe of Levi. It's not. The only priests you have up to this point that are specifically named are Aaron and his sons. They're the ones who get installed. But recall even earlier that before we had the installation of Aaron and his sons, there were others who are unnamed, other people. We don't know what tribe, you know, they're from. There's no specific tribe doing this that did priestly things. They offered offerings and sacrifices and whatnot. There were others who performed priestly tasks. Now, commentators, again, recognize that, and they use that, again, to help explicate the issue here. Commentators are in consensus that the description of the capital punishment in Exodus 32, since it's juxtaposed with the loyalty of the tribe of Levi, commentators will suggest, let me just reread it to you, just so you get the feel for it. The next day, this is, the, you know, after 3,000 are killed. The next day, Moses said to the people, "You have sinned a great sin. How? And now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for you." Again, so there's still this atonement issue. There's still people out there who are bearing guilt. So there's a wider group. And the killing itself was initiated by who's on the Lord's side. And the tribe of Levi are the ones who are loyal. So you have three groups. You got the people who are going to get killed. They're guilty of something in relation to the golden calf. You got the Levites, who are not guilty of the golden calf episode. And then you've got the wider people. So if you keep those three groups in mind, what commentators will actually do with this is they'll say, we think that those who were killed by the Levites were these other people who were doing priestly tasks prior to the creation of the actual priesthood. So whoever these people were, they become outsiders. They had formerly been doing things in the worship of Yahweh or in the service of Yahweh, you know, doing these offerings and sacrifices and whatnot that we've talked about in other parts of Exodus in relation to the priesthood. These are the ones who went to Aaron. Again, this is speculative, but again, you can see how this argument develops. These are the guys who went to Aaron, wanted this golden calf created, participated in the gathering of the material to create the golden calf. They were enthusiastic about the golden calf, blah, 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 blah. And they got the people to worship it. These are the guys who are targeted when Moses comes down from the mountain and says, "Who's on the Lord's side?" The tribe of Levi says, we're on your side. We are on Yahweh's side. We are with you, Moses. We are not defining Yahweh as this golden calf. And Moses says, well, thus says the Lord God, you know, take your sword, go kill those guys. And that this episode is the framework against which we understand later when the tribe of Levi, the whole tribe, is itself sanctified along with the priests of Aaron and his sons. That now the whole tribe of Levi essentially replaces these other guys. Like, this is the historical event that brings the status of the tribe of Levi about. Because prior to this, only Aaron and his sons were the priests. The tribe of Levi is actually never described as being the priesthood or part of the priesthood or part of any of this until after this episode. So this, the mention specifically of Levi in this episode is sort of an interpretive clue and an interpretive key for many people. And if you had 20 commentaries here on Exodus, everybody's going to talk about this because Levi is prominent in this. They're going to see this as really, again, how to sort of parse who's getting punished and whatnot. Now, if we go back to Exodus 32, 11 through 14, and Moses is saying, hey, don't annihilate the people, you know, you say, well, how would that get taken care of? Well, here's how it would go. God is angry with everybody. This is, you know, these people don't deserve, you know, me to be their God, and they've broken my command, and here they are making this grave. I'm just going to destroy everybody. I'm going to take you, Moses. Think about the wording that God uses. God says, you know, when he's threatening to destroy the people, he says, let me alone that my wrath may burn hot against them and I may consume them in order that I may make a great nation of you. So he actually quotes the Abrahamic covenant, you know, the part about making a great nation from the descendants of Abraham, and he applies it to Moses. So, you know, I'll just annihilate these people and you know, we'll start over with you, Moses. And Moses says, oh, don't do that because the Egyptians are going to say this, and, you know, they're going to look like you did this deliberately, you know, the whole bit. So God says, okay, I won't do that. And so he doesn't forgive them. He just says, I won't destroy them. Moses, you better go back down there. Moses goes down. He sees what's going on now with his own eyes and gets really ticked. And that's when he issues this challenge. Okay, who's on the Lord's side? We're going to take care of this problem. And he's speaking, you know, he's the mouthpiece for God. The text is very plain. It says, you know, thus says the Lord God. This is what Moses is saying. Thus says the Lord to the Levites who said, we're on your side. We're on the Lord's side. We're not doing this golden calf thing. Go and destroy from one end of the camp to the other. You know, your relatives, your kin, whoever it is. And they do. 3,000 people die. So the supposition is that those 3,000 people are the non-Aaronic priesthood guys that were in Israel. Somebody's doing sacrifices. Somebody's doing, you know, certain things, priestly things prior to the installation, you know, of the priesthood. Because you have references to, you know, elders and priests prior to this, prior to the establishment of Aaron and his sons. So it's those guys, again, this unnamed group. Again, this is how commentators, you know, look at the episode and how they make it fit together. And so those are the ones who are punished, but the people still need to be dealt with. Okay, God didn't destroy them, but God is still angry. And so Moses, again, realizes this, that the only people who've been dealt with here are sort of the primary perpetrators here. So Moses says, look, you still have a problem, people. You're still guilty because you participated in this. You may not have made it. Okay, you may not have been like the ringleaders here, but you went along with this. And again, it might be that you thought you were doing the right thing. This is our previous episode, chapter 32, about the rationale for the golden calf, whether that could have represented Yahweh or not. And it very well could have. But Moses says, look, you know, despite all that, this was still wrong. This is still sin. God does not accept this. So you still have a problem. So I'm going to go back up the mountain and I'm going to make intercession for you and try to make atonement for you. And then he has this second conversation with God. God says, look, I'm not going to blot you out of the book. I'm not going to do that. You know, the ones who are guilty are the ones that are going to be dealt with. And so God sends a plague on the people. And you would think, again, that takes care of it, because now we're at the end of chapter 32. So again, this is how commentators, you know, put all these elements together so that they, you can get a coherent narrative feel out of it by sort of asking yourselves and then answering, well, who's what, how many groups do we have? Who's who, who's doing what, who's, what is happening to whom, and all this sort of thing. So chapter 32 ends with this plague, but oddly enough, when you get into 33, the reader, you as the reader, still wonder if it's still over. I mean, is it actually, is the judgment actually over? Because if you get into 33, let's look at how 33 starts. The Lord said to Moses, depart, go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought up out of the land of Egypt, to the land of which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, to your offspring I will give it. I will send an angel before you, and I will drive out the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey. Now here's the key phrase. But I will not go up among you, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people. And when the people heard this disastrous word, they mourned, and no one put on his ornaments. Oddly enough, there's another reference to ornaments. Again, has a religious feel to it. For the Lord had said to Moses, verse 5, say to the people of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. If for a single moment I should go up among you, I would consume you. So now take off your ornaments, that I may know what to do with you. Therefore the people of Israel stripped themselves of their ornaments from Mount Horeb onward. Now, if these ornaments, whatever they were, have, again, like the rings of gold, if they have some religious significance, did they, like, put these things on again? Are they talismans? Is this something God is upset with? Or is God saying, look, you wear that stuff, you're not on my side. You take it off, you are on my side. Let's go. Let's see what side you're on here. Again, it's tough to know exactly what's going on because we don't know the nature of these ornaments. But at the very least, again, verse 3, I will not go up among you. Now, you would think after the plague that ended chapter 32 that the matter is settled. God's satisfied. Everybody who's deserving of punishment gets punished. And we're okay. We're okay. But it doesn't seem that they are because God says, I'm not going to go with you. So we're left, again, the reader is left with one, you know, wondering, well, what's going on now? Like, is the golden calf problem? Has it now leaked into chapter 33? Like, what's going on here? What do we make of this? You know, you might wonder how as well. I mean, I will send an angel before you, verse 2, chapter 33, verse 2, and I will drive out the Canaanites and all these other ites, but I'm not going with you. You might also wonder, especially this audience, this podcast audience, might wonder how all that's consistent with the idea back in Exodus 23, verses 20 to 23, that Yahweh's angel is in fact Yahweh, since Yahweh's name, his presence, is in that angel. Now, what we've noted so far, again, you have to ask yourself, you know, you got the angel in 23, you know, Yahweh's in the angel, the angel is Yahweh, he's just a visible Yahweh. And here in verses 2 and 3 in chapter 33, we've just had the awful golden calf thing and everybody's punished. Looks like, you know, we've got a plan here because God says in verse 2, I'm going to send an angel before you and I'm going to drive out the Canaanites, the Amorites, and everything's going well. Everything's like reset. Everything is back to normal. And then you hit verse 3, I'm not going with you. How in the world is that consistent with both the judgment and the theology of Exodus 23, that the angel is Yahweh? Well, I'm going to suggest that it actually is consistent. It's completely consistent with the angel of the Lord theology in Exodus 23 being the visible Yahweh because of some things that we're going to encounter a few verses later in chapter 33 and some wider context things. Now, here's what I mean. Here's why I think it's consistent. You know, you realize the problem. You know, like how is it consistent with the judgment and how can – now it seems like the angel isn't Yahweh because the angel's going to get sent and God says, I'm not going with you. So how does this work? Here's why I think it's completely consistent with the angel in Exodus 23 that was going to be sent with the people actually being the visible Yahweh. And that's consistent with this language here. Here's why. A couple of reasons. Number one, and Sarna is the one who points this out. I think it's worth mentioning. Sarna points out that the promise of Exodus 33:2, again, I will send an angel before you, I will drive out the Canaanites, so on and so forth. That promise closely echoes the promise of Exodus 23:20 through 33 and Exodus 32:34. But the emissary is not here in Exodus 33:2, designated by God as my angel. In other words, in Exodus 33:2, God doesn't refer to the angel he's sending as his angel, my angel. It's generic. It's just an angel. And Sarna says, you know, that change, this is Sarna's word, the change is ominous. The implication is that the angel being sent ahead of Israel in the wake of the golden calf incident is some other angel, something less than the previous one promised, who was specifically Yahweh's angel, and as I've argued many times, Yahweh himself in visible form. So I think Sarna's observation, this is just our first point, I think Sarna's observation that, you know, if you look at this carefully, you look at these other references, Exodus 23, Exodus 32, 34, it was Yahweh's angel. Here it's not. And Sarna thinks that the change in wording is significant, and I would agree. Secondly, the threat of Exodus 33:3, and again, that's where God says, go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go up among you, lest I consume you on the way. The threat in that verse where Yahweh says he is not going to go up with Israel is actually more of a testing of Moses than an intended reality. Why do I say that? Well, let's read Exodus 33, verse 4 through the end of the chapter. Let's read what else happens after God says, I will not go up among you. What happens? Because this is going to tell us that, well, yeah, God said he wasn't going to go up, but maybe he does. maybe God does after all, and we don't have this problem with the angel. So here we are in verse 4. Let me read it. When the people heard this disastrous word, they mourned, and no one put on his ornaments. For the Lord had said to Moses, say to the people of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. If for a single moment I should go up among you, I would consume you. So now take off your ornaments, that I may know what to do with you. Therefore the people of Israel stripped themselves of their ornaments from Mount Horeb onward. Now Moses used to take the tent and pitch it outside the camp, far off from the camp. And he called it the tent of meeting. And everyone who sought the Lord would go out to the tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. Whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people would rise up, and each would stand at his tent door and watch Moses until he had gone into the tent. When Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent, and the Lord would speak with Moses. And when all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, all the people would rise up and worship each at his tent door. Thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend. When Moses turned again into the camp, his assistant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, would not depart from the tent. Moses said to the Lord, see, you say to me, bring up this people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, I know you by name, and you have also found favor in my sight. Now let me stop there. The part about the tent of meeting is really interruptive. God says to Moses, I ain't going with you. The people freak out, like, oh, what are we going to do now? You know, and God says, okay, you know, we'll see what we're going to do with you. You know, take off the ornaments and so on and so forth. Get moving. And then we had this thing about the tent. Well, it's there to establish that Moses and God had a close relationship. God spoke to Moses face to face. So then when we come back to Moses in the scene, after God has told him he's not going to go up with him, Moses said to the Lord, see, you say to me, bring up this people, go take them to the land, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, I know you by name, and you have also found favor in my sight. Now, that could be a reference, you've not let me know whom you will send with me. Is Moses suggesting, is he asking, what angel are you going to send with me? If it's not this other angel that, you know, we've seen Yahweh in human form. We've seen you, Lord, in human form before. And, you know, I, again, readers of Unseen Realm will know why I say this, or listeners of the podcast. You know, we've had God in human form at the bush. We've had God in human form on Mount Sinai. We've had, you know, a number of episodes, and Moses knows this. He is the one who is privy to this. So now Moses is like, well, just who are you going to send with me? If you're not going to go, if you're not going to go with us, who's this angel? I mean, who is this? Because it's not you. I mean, it's actually an implied evidence that Moses knows that the earlier, you know, Yahweh in human form is the angel that had originally been promised. But now he's uncertain. Like, okay, if it's not you, then who is it? Like, what's going on? Who are you going to send with me? If it's not you, I want to know who it is. Okay, so, you know, we can make sense of the language. And Moses is like, you know, you're doing this to me, yet I know you by name, and you have also found, you tell me that I've found favor in your sight. This is what you're saying. You know, you have said to me, I know you by name, and you have also found favor in my sight. Now, therefore, if I have found favor in your sight, please show me your ways that I may know you in order to find favor in your sight. Consider, too, that this nation is your people. Here's God's response in verse 14. And he, God, said, my presence will go with you. Okay? My presence. Now, there's something interesting in Hebrew here. A couple of things interesting in Hebrews. My presence will go with you. That's ESV. In the Hebrew, the words with you are not in there. It just says, my presence will go, and I will give you, and the verb is, you know, the form is singular. I will give you rest. Now, rest, if you're going to look at the conquest accounts, I will give you rest. The phrase about giving people rest means it means subduing the land's inhabitants. For instance, Joshua 21:44 says this: the Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their fathers. Not one of all their enemies had withstood them, for the Lord had given all their enemies into their hands. So giving them rest is conquering the enemies. Joshua 22:4, and now the Lord your God has given rest to your brothers as he promised them. Therefore, turn and go to your tents in the land where your possession lies, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side of the Jordan. Joshua 23:1. A long time afterward, when the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their surrounding enemies, and Joshua was old and well advanced in years. Okay, so this idea of giving rest is subduing the land's inhabitants. So, you know, God has now said in verse 14, back up in, let me just read it to you. Back up in chapter 33, verse 2. I'll send an angel, just a generic angel with you, and I'll drive out the Canaanites, but I'm not going with you. Now here he says, my presence will go, and I will give you, again, singular, I will give you rest. I'll subdue the inhabitants of the land. Verse 15, and he said to him, this is Moses talking now, Moses said to him, if your presence will not go with me, do not bring us up from here. For how shall it be? Or how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not in your going with us, so that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth? And the Lord said to Moses, this very thing that you have spoken I will do, for you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name. Moses said, this is verse 18, please show me your glory. Let's stop there. Look at the conversation. God is reassuring him, look, I will go. And we can't say that he's saying this just for Moses' sake, like to give Moses peace. I'll give you, singular, you, Moses, I'll give you rest, just you. No, because the singular about, the singular pronoun you is also singular back in verse 3. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go up among you. That's singular as well. So it actually refers to the whole people. It actually refers to them collectively, to Israel collectively. And he's speaking to Moses because Moses is the representative leader. So this is a promise. You know, God says, okay, I know I said I would just send a generic angel. Not my angel. I'll send an angel. We're hearkening back to Sarna's observation here. But I'm not going with you. Here in verses 14 through 17, God changes his mind. Or again, back in verses 2 and 3, God was saying that to test Moses, you know, to see how he would respond. And, you know, we can see in verses 12 and following, we can see how Moses responds. You know, he pleads with God. You know, you say, bring up this people, but you've not let me know who you're going to send with me. Like, what am I supposed to do now? If it's not you, I don't want to go. If it's not you, don't send us up. Again, this dialogue, again, tells you that Moses understood that the original promised angel back in 23, that's referred to by Yahweh as my angel, okay, Moses understood who that was. Moses understood that this is Yahweh present as a man, in visible form, just like at the burning bush. Moses gets it. And when it seems like it's withdrawn, like it's like God says, I'm not going with you. Oh yeah, I'll send an angel, but I'm not going with you. Like it has to be some other angel. Now Moses says, I don't know who you're going to send now. And he's troubled. Obviously he's troubled. And then God says, look, I will go with you. My presence, verse 14, my panim, my presence will go. And I will also do your enemies. I'll do what I originally promised. And then when Moses hears that, you know, and God reassures, this thing I've spoken I will do. What's Moses' response? Show me your glory. Moses wants to see. He wants to see what he saw in the burning bush. You know, he wants the full blast here. You know, he's either taking advantage of the opportunity now, you know, that he's having this conversation with God to see more than he's gotten to see, like he's trying to he's going to get everything out of this conversation that he can get, or it's something a little, you know, pared back, a little simpler, that, okay, I want to see what I saw in the bush there. I want to see, you know, the angel, your angel. I want to see you in visible form. Show me your glory. You know, you could also read it and say, well, okay, I know who that is. And I've seen the bush, and we know who this angel is. And Moses could also be asking for more. He wants to see God's presence directly, not mediated by the angel. I mean, you could read it that way too. And when we get to chapter 34, next episode, I tend to think that Moses could be going down that trajectory. But what God replies in verse 19 is, you know, God says, I will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim before you my name, the Lord. Oh, isn't that interesting? Yes, you know, Moses, I will proclaim my name. You know, it's the name that's in the angel. And what Moses is actually going to see in chapter 34 is Yahweh as a man, but just the back parts. Okay, if you remember chapter 34, which we'll get into next time. So this language is tied back into the angel in whom is the name of chapter 23. And so Moses knows, again, that angel is different. That angel is Yahweh. That angel is the presence of Yahweh in visible human form. And since he knows that, that's why he's troubled when you get to, you know, verses 2 and 3 here in chapter 33, when God says, yeah, I'll send an angel, but I'm not going with you. Moses knows that's not the same. That's not the same. So I think Sarna's observation is really on target here. I think it really plays well, into the interpretation of what's happening here, and shows that it is consistent. All of this is consistent with this one angel being Yahweh again in visible form, visible human form. So, you know, get back to verse 19. I will make all my goodness pass before you, will proclaim before you my name, Yahweh, the Lord. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. But he said, you cannot see my face, my panim. You can't see my presence. But God had just said in verse 14, my presence will go with you. Well, sure it will. As a man, as the angel. But he's saying to Moses, look, you can't see my presence, just my presence, you know, unveiled, not in human form. You can't see that. For man shall not see me and live. And the Lord said, behold, there's a place by me where you shall stand on the rock, And while my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand. By the way, God has to be embodied as a human to have a hand. I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take away my hand, you shall see my back. But my face, my panim, you know, again, I take that as the unveiled presence. That shall not be seen. So we're going to talk about that a little bit more, and a lot more in the next episode in chapter 34. But for our purposes now, note the interchange. What this means with respect to the angel question is that God is going to go. He is going to go. The original angel, my angel, his angel, is going to go with Moses. So it's not a contradiction. He promises that his presence will be with Israel when they go into the land. Now, this what's really important here is the parallel in Isaiah 63:9. Because there, Isaiah 63:9, when it's recounting the history of this, you know, the Exodus from Egypt and then the journey to the land, it actually refers to the delivering angel as the angel of the presence, the angel of God's presence. And so bringing all these data together creates consistency with Exodus 23:20-23, that the angel in whom Yahweh's name or presence was would go before Israel. He is going to go. God will be with them. He will give them rest. That angel was God himself in visible form. Again, we'll pick up more of it. I want to wrap up this episode. I want to say a few things about the odd sort of interruptive section about the tent of meeting, just a little bit here. And then I want to reference some articles that, you know, you can reference for, you know, for some literary, you know, analysis and just, you know, telegraph to you what you're going to get there. But in Exodus 33:7-11, now Moses used to take the tent, pitch it outside the camp, far off from the camp, and he called it the tent of meeting. And everyone who sought the Lord would go out to the tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. Whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people would rise up. Each would stand at his tent door and watch Moses until he had gone into the tent, so on and so forth. Now, this is a good place to remind ourselves. So we had a couple episodes on the tabernacle. It's a good place to remind ourselves that the term tent of meeting and tabernacle are not completely synonymous, though there is definite overlap. Now, as we talked about earlier in the episodes on the tabernacle structure, the tent of meeting was obviously covered with a tent. That's why it's a tent of meeting. It has a tent. The tabernacle itself, though, was not. The tabernacle just had a tented part, the internal part of it. The tented part of the tabernacle was within the walls of the overall tabernacle structure. In other words, the tented part of the tabernacle was the tent of meeting. But the two, you know, they're not completely synonymous. It appears that before the tabernacle's construction, that's going to happen in Exodus 35 and onward, the tent of meeting existed outside the camp. Afterward, the tent of meeting, and after the tabernacle is actually built, the tent of meeting would refer to the Holy of Holies or the entire tented holy place. Could refer to part of the, you know, the tented area where the, you know, above where the ark was, or the whole tented area inside the tabernacle. Now, again, you know, if you had Bible software, all you got to do is look up tent of meeting and tabernacle where they occurred together, and you're going to see this distinction. So I think this is a good place to remind ourselves of that. Because, again, there are critics who would use this, again, to say that this is contradictory and it reflects different sources and whatnot. You just don't have to go there. When we talked about the tabernacle itself, like with Friedman, you know, the controversy over Friedman's idea that the tented structure, the tent of meeting, you know, the tent was moved inside the temple when the temple was constructed. Again, this is just me. I think that they're, you know, unless you're just going to take those metaphorically, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of merit for that. If those verses mean what they say, this would make sense. It would make sense that the tent of meeting, the tent, is different than the overall tabernacle, and it refers to a subset, you know, of the tabernacle institution, or the tabernacle sacred space that was covered by the tabernacle. It makes sense that this is a subset. that could actually go inside the temple. Again, you could go back to those episodes and listen to that. But again, this is a good place to remind ourselves that the terminology overlaps, but we don't have, you know, a totally synonymous relationship here. Now, lastly, again, I want to draw your attention to two articles I put in the protected folder that provide literary and structural analysis of Exodus 32-34. Again, if you're interested, you can get access to these articles. I do think that they are, you know, certainly, you know, worthwhile, you know, taking a look at. The titles of the articles are, one is by Ralph Hendricks, A Literary Structural Analysis of the Golden Calf Episode of Exodus 32:1 through 33:6. It's an Andrews University Seminary Studies Journal article. And on page 212, he takes Exodus 32 and 33 and puts it into a nice chiasm. And then he summarizes the conclusions. It's interesting, if you look at the chiasm, and obviously this doesn't translate well to podcasting, but if you get the article, you can look at it. The central point of the chiasm is Exodus 32:26a, the first part of verse 26, which is the opportunity for repentance among the people. So that seems to be, again, what the writer was trying to get the people, you know, was trying to get his readers to see as the most important thing in these two chapters. So you have, you know, lots of parallels, just like a chiasm works. You have first six verses of Exodus 32 are going to parallel verses 33, 4 through 6. Okay, you just have to go look at it visually. But this would explain, again, if the chiasm works, and it certainly seems to work, it's actually very obvious once you see it, this would explain why the episode isn't given in strict chronological fashion. The writer doesn't want to do that. He wants to chop up the elements, put them in a chiastic structure to highlight the theme of repentance. You know, that's just what they're doing. It doesn't mean that the events aren't historical. It means that's not the way history is told. That's not the way history is put forth in biblical literature. This happens, again, this literary kind of stuff happens a lot. The second article is by Dale Ralph Davis, Rebellion, Presence, and Covenant, A Study in Exodus 32 through 34. This is from Westminster Theological Journal in 1982. The other one was in 1990. This actually gives several possible structures that are not chiasms of chapter 32. And then within chapter 32, he offers a chiastic structure that is different than Hendricks, because Hendricks goes through over both chapters. But Davis actually offers one within chapter 32. And again, highlighting important themes, theological teaching themes in the presentation of the material. This is often, here's the point, this is often how the Old Testament, and it, really the Gospels do this too, this is how the Bible presents history. Okay, it tells you something happened, and you can believe that something happened. The information that XYZ happened is trustworthy. But in the telling of what happened, the writers always want you to learn something. They want you to see something. They want you to be thinking about not just the nuts and bolts of, oh, this event happened. You know, and here we had this event that was followed by that event and another event. This is how we do history. Rather, what they want you to do is they want you to recognize things that happened in the past and what it teaches you about God or yourself or the people in the story. You know, what are the spiritual lessons? So scripture will present a retelling of the past in this way. It is not interested in many instances of producing a catalog or a chronology or an itinerary. They just don't do history the way we do in many cases. You know, sometimes it does, but in many cases, I would say it's even fair to say most cases, biblical writers just don't do history the way we do. They have different goals in mind, but none of that falsifies the real-time events that something real happened here, and this is a faithful retelling that these events happened. But the reason we're retelling the events or telling you about those events is not to give you an exhausted chronicle. It's so that you'll learn something about God and salvation history and the people of God and so on and so forth. This is why the Bible does what it does. This is how it does history. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, again, these are in the protected folder. I think you'll find them interesting. But we can't, again, since it's visual, can't really do that on the podcast. So I'm just going to wrap up this episode here and say for next time, we're going to get into Exodus 34 when the fulfillment of this conversation Moses has just had with God about seeing his glory, when that, again, transpires and what we can learn from that, both in terms of biblical theology and, again, just about what's going on the ground with the people of God and Moses during these events in the Exodus.
All right, Mike, sounds good. All right. We'll be looking forward to that, and hopefully by then maybe you'll have a tan or somewhat of a
better tan. Maybe it'll get into the 60s, right? Yeah. And even though it's chilly, the sun is out. Yeah. That is true.
That's right. More so than Washington State.
Yeah. Yeah, somebody asked me if I brought the weather with me from Seattle because it was so cold here the first week, and I said, well, I looked up and saw the sun, so that told me where I was.
All right, Mike. Well, we appreciate it as always, and we'll look forward to chapter 34 next week. And with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.